continue on respiratory tract. So we talk about tuberculosis, a very common communicable disease. We as healthcare providers always have to get a skin test. Everyone got their skin test for this year? No? Good. So tuberculosis is a hypersensitivity reaction type 4. And we talk about that forming granulomas. It used to be a real problem in the United States prior to anti-tubercular medication and also public health policy and prevention. And this becomes very important. So it's a chronic inflammatory process to this Mycobacterium tuberculosis organism. And worldwide, it's a leading cause of death. Especially in the AIDS population in the world, it's a leading cause of infectious death because the CD4 helper cells that create the granuloma are destroyed by the HIV virus, and you cannot form granulomas to destroy it or wall it off. And that's the problem. So we talk about it's been declining. The number of cases of TB is anywhere between 15 to 20,000. It varies. Before that, when it was in its epidemic phase in the United States, it was 135,000, 150,000 cases in the United States. So it's obviously gone down significantly. But there are other parts of the world where it's endemic. And the problem that you have to be concerned about is that these organisms are slow growing. They have a doubling rate of 45 hours. And you often have to treat them for what? Patients for months, 6 months to 9 months on various anti-tubercular medications, and they can gain resistance. And you get these super strains. And there's not much else you can do with it. The number of antibiotics shrinks in terms of sensitivity to it, so this is a real problem when you develop this. Especially when people only get half treated or treat themselves and they don't follow up, it becomes a real problem. So you have to follow the whole treatment protocol. This is one graph or table that illustrates TB. If you take 100 people and you expose them to TB organism, what percentage will come down with active TB is 10%. Because this organism is small enough, it's going to get in the alveolar sac. And what cell is ready to eat it? What cell lives in the alveolar sac that we talked about last time? Macrophage, that's right. The macrophage will then eat it, transport it, break it down, and present it to the immune system so that if you get a skin test, now it turns positive if you have an intact immune system. So what you're seeing on this graph is what happens to the 10% of people who have a hypersensitivity reaction to it. And that's important to realize, that just because you get the organism, that means everyone's going to look like this is not true. Because remember, hypersensitivity reactions are dependent upon your genetic makeup. And so this represents 10% who have active disease. If you get a positive skin test, and all the previous ones have been negative, what do they do next? The chest x-ray, because the portal of entry is the lung, so therefore they want to see if you have active disease. And if it's negative, then you got to make a choice of taking INH for 6 months. But most of these tubercular medications have to be processed or metabolized by the liver, and you have to worry about hepatic toxicity. So when you look at the patient of the 10% who have active disease, this is how they're going to present. And if you look at it here, because it's a facultative aerobic organism, it likes the better ventilation in the upper lobes, and so out in the periphery, you get basically a GON focus. GON was a physician who described this in the 1920s in Europe, and you see caseation. The microorganism and or the macrophage travels through the lymphatics to the higher lymph nodes and produces granulomas there, caseation, and this is now called a GON complex. But this is what is called the primary. Now you have several choices. What's going to happen to the patient? One, you wall it off, and now it becomes scar tissue. That walled off area may still contain viable organisms, which can reactivate later on what they call local reactivation or latent infections that's dormant for years or decades. They've done studies where they've taken TB-infected tissue, put it in formaldehyde, put it in paraffin blocks, come back 10 years, go to the microbiology lab, and 2 to 3% of them will grow out active TB. This is one tough bug. And so it's been a major world health problem, and it's difficult to attack because it's slow growing and it can be encased within these fibrous areas and like the scar here, and then you get reactivation. Or it heals it completely and nothing happens, like it's shown here. Another problem that could occur in the primary is that the patient is so sensitive to the microorganism that you get such an extensive hypersensitivity reaction, you get what is called progressive pulmonary tuberculosis. And so large areas of damage occurs, caseation to the lungs. And now the probability of getting through the bloodstream and leaving the lungs is much greater. We call now this disseminated tuberculosis. And now the TB can go to various organs, starting from the head, going to your toes. It can go to your meninges in the base of your brain, causing chronic meningitis. It can go into your neck and produce cervical lymphadenitis. An old term for it is scrofula. It can go to your vocal cords. By the way, you don't have to cough to spread it. If it's in your vocal cords in a disseminated patient, all by just by talking and vibrating your vocal cords can now release the organisms into the air, and you can get it that way. Now it goes down into the chest, besides the lungs, where the primary start, where it starts is the portal of entry. Then it can get to your heart and produce on the surface of the heart, like the surface of the brain, a chronic constrictive pericarditis, causing problems with heart function. And then you can see the two organs below the diaphragm here is the liver and the spleen. We'll get this, what is called miliary TB. You get these millet seed or small granulomas. Each one of those granulomas represents one organism. So it's like seeds that are being populated. It can go to your spine, your thoracic and lumbar spine, cause a chronic osteomyelitis called Pott's disease. That can be very destructive. It can go to your adrenal glands, causing adrenal insufficiency. It can go in the female to the fallopian tubes, produce a chronic salpingitis, lead to infertility. It can go to the epididymis of the male and lead to infertility. It can also go to your intestine. And it can go to bone, like the bone I talked about, but also the skin. It's not so much common in the skin, but it can occur there, especially in the disseminated form. So reactivation, you have it, or you get exposed to it again, and you get secondary TB, and usually occurs in the apical portion of the upper lobes of the lungs. And then it can go through the dissemination and then produce a miliary pattern in various organs. This is the classic pattern of TB, both for primary or latent or reactivation TB. So it's important to realize that the hypersensitivity reaction type 4 is genetically determined, and this only represents 10% of the population, while most of us will clear the organism, and that's why getting the skin test is a good measure of seeing whether your immune system sees it or not. Obviously, if you're an AIDS patient, your skin test would always be negative, typically, because you wiped out the CD4 helper cells. But now they're treating patients with heart therapy, antiviral medications, so their CD4 count are higher, and a number of them now have positive skin tests if they do have TB. But it's an issue of maintaining the structural integrity of the immune system. So when you look at TB, this is what miliary TB looks like. You see the red arrows show you these little white nodules. Those are each a granuloma. And you can see throughout the lung, it's disseminated. So each one of those little white nodules is the size of a millet seed, which if you go to a grocery store, you can see bird seed, the parrots, those little round seeds. Think of those as miliary seeds, and they are granulomas. Yes?
With HIV, you said it can't, or the issue is lack of CD4 cells.
Right. If you have a patient with active disease not getting antiviral medication, and you wipe out the CD4. But if you're taking antiviral medication and have normal levels of CD, then you should have a positive skin test. That's what I was trying to show, because it's changed now. But it's still a problem in AIDS patients that you can have dormancy and reactivation years later. Okay? This is what a granulomas look like. This is a miliary seed. You can see the area is caseation here. Here's another one here, another one here, and another one here. Do you think this lung can regenerate itself once you have all these granulomas? Yes or no? No. This is permanent, irreversible damage. This is very destructive. One of the common symptoms of people who have active tuberculosis is a chronic hemoptysis, chronic bleeding. If you have patients who are coughing up blood, there's two things you have to think of right away that's highly destructive. One is tuberculosis, the other is lung cancer. So any patient that's coughing up bright red blood, that because of the destructive nature of the disease. And so these are just the granulomas and multinucleated giant cells. Here we see the caseation in the center, a microscopically fragmentation of the nuclei, and then you see an epithelioid cell, a nucleus surrounded by pink cytoplasm, indistinct cellular borders, and a multinucleated giant cell made of many macrophages that are fused with one another. Here is a one that's at the apex, and it doesn't look like cheese, and you can see some of the lymph nodes have also in the hilar area. If you look carefully, you can see it spread to the and cause caseation to the hilar lymph nodes. So it's traveling through the lymphatics we talked about to the hilar area, and then it can disseminate two ways, through the lymphatics and enter the venous blood or enter the arterial blood and disseminate. So it has several options. Fungal infections are not uncommon, and they can occur both in the compromised and immunocompromised. And basically, these are called visceral or deep-seated mycoses. Mycosis is a condition of fungus. And they can occur in you and I. The most common fungus we have to worry about in this part of the world or country is coccidiomycosis or San Joaquin Valley fever. And that's when you've got all these spores of coccidiomycosis in the soil. So when you're driving into the San Joaquin Valley, you see dust storms in different parts. When it's very dry and arid, you have to think of all the spores that are being whipped up into the air and being aerosolized and then taking it in. So usually fungal infections, when they're active and disseminating in the body, the portal of entry is typically the lungs. Usually you're immunocompromised. And things that lead to an immunocompromised state, you think of chemotherapy and radiation therapy, especially if it's going to damage the bone marrow. And prolonged antibiotic therapy, because we have a microflora in the gut, in our oral cavity, that when you have different bacteria, they also keep the environment inhospitable for fungal organisms. So if you're on chronic antibiotics and you change that microbiological ecosystem, then what happens is other species can flourish like fungal organisms. And this is what also can lead to an opportunity for the fungus to cause portal entry into the respiratory tract and disseminate. So another thing is immunosuppression. No matter what you're taking, steroids, for example, for various conditions, other immunosuppressive drugs, you always have to be concerned about that within the patient. When we talk about normal or immunocompromised, there are different parts of the country. You think of histoplasmosis in the Mississippi-Ohio Valley is a common place for this organism. So people are traveling all over this country as well as different parts of the world. And you always have to be important to get a travel history. Coccidiomycosis is this part of the country in San Joaquin Valley in the Southwest. You find it in Nevada, Arizona, besides California. Another fungus that one can see is in North America, from Canada all down to Central America and Mexico, is blastomycosis. Another fungus that can be found in a variety of areas in the United States is Cryptococcus. It's usually seen in immunocompromised hosts, especially if they're immunosuppressed, as you mentioned earlier. When you get somebody with chemotherapy for cancer or other immunosuppressive protocols that one uses for various things like organ transplantation, for example, you have to worry about patients who get Candida. That's why Candida was an indicator disease in AIDS, but it can be seen in many other conditions. If you're a diabetic, you're immunocompromised, and you can get candidiasis. So having oral thrush, or you have esophagitis, or you have a Candida infection of the skin, they come in various forms. So you think of somebody who's immunocompromised. This is the most common fungus. There are yeast that you see. Another one that's very common in our environment is Aspergillus. It's a very common one. And so, here we go. It's very common. And in San Francisco, for example, when it's a foggy day, you have about 150 spores that you inhale each day. You don't realize it, but you're inhaling it. And basically, your macrophages are taking care of it, and nothing really happens. And other people, if they get Aspergillus, they can lead to asthma, for example, as a trigger. So it's interesting fungus that one is very common and ubiquitous, that it's not uncommon to see in patients. Virus, the last organism we're going to talk about in terms of infection of the lung. Viral pneumonias are typically seen in the elderly and the very young. And this is typically, when I say young, under the age of one or the elderly, when the immune system is most vulnerable. And viruses can set up, like adenovirus, set up what are called superinfections. And what it means is that you've damaged the mucociliary clearance, like in the respiratory tract with the virus, and then you allow other bacteria like Staphylococcus aureus to take hold and cause very severe necrotizing, bronchiolitis, tracheitis, esophagitis, and lead to sepsis and death. And so when you have a virus, it can lead to other infections. And so this is a thing that you have to worry about. People who don't get immunizations, for example, you can get measles pneumonia, for example, especially when you're older. And so it's important to realize that when you haven't seen an antigen stimulation like a virus, then when you get older, it may be very robust, your immunologic response to it, and can lead to tissue injury. So when we think of viruses, we have to think of the entire respiratory tract, upper and lower. So everyone in this room has had a common cold. This is a very common situation. And then people have probably maybe had flu. So I get the flu shots. It's a more systemic reaction. And you're going to get fever because you have more activated T lymphocytes and macrophages secreting TNF and IL-1. Then it can go down to the airways like adenovirus or respiratory syncytial virus. These are examples of acute bronchitis. And then once it gets down to the alveolar sacs, the alveolar walls, it can lead to a pneumonia. Because most pneumonias people think of are bacterial. So when a virus is involved, we have a different set of cells compared to PMNs coming in. It's going to be lymphocytes. If you have secondary damage to the tissue, then you get acute inflammatory response. And so this is what is called, ever hear the term clinically in a patient, is atypical pneumonia. When they use that term, they think of viruses or certain bacteria like mycoplasma that can also lead to an unusual pattern on an x-ray or high-resolution spiral CT scan of the chest, and that is because it involves T lymphocytes, it's going to travel through the lymphatics, which are found in the interlobular septa, and you give what is called an interstitial pattern versus acute bronchial pneumonia or a lobar pneumonia we talked about with bacteria. But you may hear the term atypical pneumonia. It means it's not a typical bacterium that we talk about, staph or streptococcus, and it could be a virus or mycoplasma bacteria that's an exception to this. This is an example of pneumonia due to virus, and this is CMV, cytomegalo. And this is a herpes, it's in the herpes family, it's a DNA virus. And here you can see it's replicating in these cells. These large cells are filled with virions of the DNA virus or herpes virus. And it's also replicating in the cytosol, making these mega big. And there's some examples. Any questions about pneumonia? It's a very common condition that one sees in various settings. And so some of you have had it, I've had it. So look for it. It'll be looking for you. Another condition that can occur in the lung is, I'm going to show you both acute and chronic forms. And this is called diffuse infiltrative lung disease. It has hundreds of different causes and have different patterns. And so I'm just going to use two examples. In your syllabus chapter, it goes through other examples as well, but they illustrate the whole issue of the four variables we talked about: pressure, volume, compliance, and contractility. When you talk about diffuse infiltrative lung disease, what structure you're thinking of, you think of the alveolar walls, alveolar sacs, and the conduits or airways. And they have various radiologic and appearances and different pathogenesis, but they all involve what? They have a very common pattern, and that is because I've damaged the alveolar walls throughout all the lobes or the airways, what's a common complaint? What's going to have the gas exchange? If you affect all the alveolar walls, decrease. So what are you always going to complain about? Shortness of breath, dyspnea. And this is a very common feature. And so what's going to happen is they may have a productive or non-productive cough. and depending upon the chronicity and stimulating mucus production. Then you notice weight loss, fever, and night sweats. Well, what does that refer to? Is macrophages are activated, both in the acute and chronic forms of these diseases. And now it's leading to release of TNF and IL-1, and TNF is a cachexin, and that's basically we get unintentional weight loss because you suppress your appetite, and this is chronically. So it's a diffuse infiltrative pattern on a chest x-ray, and his unique characteristics you can see on a high-resolution spiral chest x-ray. So if the surface area is altered, what happens to gas exchange? What happens to gas exchange? Decreased. So what are you going to retain? CO2. So you're going to get a respiratory acidosis. And what's going to be the oxygen level? The saturation in the blood is going to be less than 95%. It can go all the way down to 40, 50, 60%. And so that means you have severe diffusion capacities reduced. And because I've damaged the wall, what happens to its compliance in any of these conditions, acute or chronic? What happens to compliance? Decreases. So what happens to the lung volume? Decreases. So that's why you call this a restrictive lung disease as a consequence to this. So the compliance is decreased. The volume is also going to be decreased. So this is why they call these conditions restrictive. So when you look at these conditions, there's different etiologies. You have a table in your syllabus to illustrate. This is just showing infections, viruses, bacteria, neoplasms, tumors, occupational environmental hazards. What do you think of asbestos, silicosis, co-workers, pneumoconiosis. Drugs like bleomycin is a chemotherapeutic drug that has pulmonary toxicity, as an example. You think of SLE or autoimmune diseases. Rheumatoid arthritis can lead to damage to the lung. You think of pulmonary vascular disease, vasculitides like Richter's granulomatosis. It destroys capillaries, not only in the lung, but also the kidneys, as well as anti-glomerular basement membrane and good pastures, where you have antibodies to the collagen type 4. Another example is specific disorders that have unknown etiology. An example of that is sarcoidosis, a condition of chronic systemic granulomatous inflammation of unknown etiology and a diagnosis of exclusion that destroys the lung parenchyma and affects the scarring and the granulomas throughout the lungs, leading to a decreased compliance and decreased volume, leading to restrictive pattern. And then interstitial pneumonias, there are a variety of ones that involve viruses, but also you can have an unknown etiology called pulmonary interstitial fibrosis, or PIF, pulmonary interstitial fibrosis is the 50% is idiopathic, and sometimes it can be familial, that certain families have a propensity for these diseases. So one of the common occurrence that occurs in the lung is a condition called ARDS, acute respiratory distress syndrome, or acute lung injury. You'll hear this clinically. And acute lung injury means that the type 1 pneumocytes have died because of some type of damage to them. One of the things you see in this diagram here is that you have to think of how you can damage the lung. You can damage it in two basic mechanisms. One, from the outside world, inhalation of some type of fume, vapor, or dust, or gas. Or you destroy it through the intravascular highway or the capillary network within the alveolar walls, which leads to destruction. What are some examples that could destroy your type 1 pneumocytes, and they form what these called hyaline membranes, you can see in pink here. And that is, you think of somebody in a burning building or an automobile accident and the car is caught on fire and they inhale the smoke. That can cause acute lung injury because all the toxins within that smoke can damage the type 1 pneumocytes, they die, and they form these hyaline membranes that are now going to increase the decrease the diffusion capacity, and then you're going to lead to acute hypoxia as a consequence to this. And because you form the hyaline membranes, the lung mass increases, decreasing compliance, decreasing volume, and now it's a restrictive pattern. If you think of these people on YouTube doing these cinnamon challenges or whatever challenge, you inhale a powder, you could cause, if you got to duff it down your alveolar sacs, and some people, you could cause acute lung injury just by inhaling that dust. People who in 9/11, when they inhaled the dust from that coming, they were caught, they develop acute lung injury in a number of cases because the amount of particulate matter they inhaled and went down to their alveolar sacs. So it causes damage. Drowning, salt water. If you drown in salt water, that all that high salinity and ions can cause damage to the lung and the alveolar sacs, and that could lead to ARDS. What about inside? You think of drugs like bleomycin. You think of DIC, disseminated intravascular coagulopathy, sickle cell. Sickling within the capillaries with the lung can cause hypoxic damage to the type 1 pneumocytes, leading to hyaline membrane disease. Pancreatitis. You have your pancreas that is damaged due to alcohol or gallstone, and it releases enzymes into the blood, and the venous blood returns to the lungs, and now those lytic enzymes of chymotrypsin, trypsin, digest and damage the walls and lead to hyaline membranes. So there's many ways of damaging the lung, and the lung is a very vulnerable organ. This is what a chest x-ray looks like. You can see why, and what's the time frame for this condition? Within hours to a few days. That's why they call it acute lung injury. And so when you look at this chest x-ray, you notice you can't see, there's increased density within the lungs, it's diffuse, and you can't see the cardiac silhouette, which you can see a basic, a little outline of it here, and then you can't really see the domes of the diaphragm. So it's telling you it's destroying the alveolar walls. Here's what the lung looks grossly. You can see instead of being pink, because you've damaged the capillaries within the wall of the alveolar sacs, then what happens is you can get a lot of pulmonary hemorrhage, and that will also impede gas exchange, leading to further hypoxia as a consequence. And as you have more and more hemorrhage in the alveolar sacs, what's going to happen to its compliance? Decrease. And what's going to happen to the total lung volume? Decrease. So you have restrictive lung pattern in a very acute way. This is what it looks like microscopically. You see these hyaline membranes, they're pink. They're going along the contours of the alveolar walls, and they represent the cellular debris due to dead type 1 pneumocytes. Who's going to replace them? Is the type 2 pneumocytes in response to the cellular injury. Can you regenerate and reconstitute the pneumocytes? Yes, as long as you don't cause permanent repeating acute lung injury leading to permanent scarring, because we know that scar is irreversible. So chronic diffuse infiltrative lung disease means what type of tissue is being laid down? Fibrosis. Anytime I hear chronic, what should I always think of? Scarring, fibrosing. Is this going to be reversible? No. And so there's that IPF, or it's also called usual interstitial pneumonitis, and it's interstitial or idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis. And what happens to all scar tissue? Contracts. So what happens to compliance? What happens to volume? Decrease. So that's a repetitive. Whether it's acute or chronic lung injury, this is a common presentation. You're going to have hypersensitivity pneumonitis, where it's going to go bronchiocentric. In other words, you're inhaling spores or some vapor, and it's causing injury chronically to your small airways, bronchioles, and this can cause scarring and fibrosing and lead also decreased compliance and decreased lung volume. It can extend out into the alveolar sacs around the airways. How many people have been in a hot tub? Okay. One of the sources of bacteria, can bacteria live in a hot tub? The answer is yes. They're what are called thermophilic bacteria. And if you don't have the proper chlorination, they can grow in there. And because you're in a hot tub, you can actually breathe it in. Some people can get the spores from the bacteria that live in the hot tub, and you can inhale it and get into your lungs and cause a hypersensitivity pneumonitis. Connective tissue disorders like rheumatoid arthritis, SLE, immunocomplexes, scleroderma. We have all that fibroblastic activity occurring throughout the body. These are places that can also lead to permanent scarring. Then if you inhale a fume, vapor, or dust leading to chronic fibrosing lung disease, like asbestosis I mentioned, silicosis, like sandblasters, and beryllium, a metal you can inhale. Here's the chronic. What cell do we see in the center when we think of chronic? Is a macrophage. And this female macrophage, what are they stimulating? A fibroblast laying down collagen. And what happens to the type 1 pneumocytes? They get damaged, both in acute and chronic infiltrative lung disease, leading to replacement by type 2 pneumocytes, hypertrophy and hyperplasia, in response to the loss of the type 1 pneumocytes. What does this look? Here's another diagram illustrating this process. You can see a normal alveolar wall thickness. Then you see there's inflammatory cells come in, the type 1 pneumocytes die, type 2 replace it. But then what do you notice about the fibrosis? What happens to the thickness of the alveolar wall? It becomes thicker and thicker. What happens to diffusion capacity? What happens to it? Decreases. What is the patient always going to complain about? Shortness of breath, dyspnea. Doesn't matter what the cause is. Is this irreversible or reversible lung injury? Irreversible. So how do you think they have to treat these patients? Transplantation is correct. That's what the only choice you have left. If there's an inflammatory component to it, if you do a lung biopsy, then you give them steroids. But it won't reverse the fibrosis, typically. So this is what a chest x-ray looks like with somebody with a chronic interstitial lung disease. And if you look carefully, you see there's increased density scarring compared to the upper lobes here where you have more radiolucency, this more opacity, and it's subpleural, and you can see it's bilateral. Here's what the lung looks like. It's very shrunken and fibrotic. If you look carefully, you can see the fibrosis here. And then if you look at this part of the lung in the lower part, here's the pleura, and you see all the scar tissue. And this is what is called honeycomb change. What happens is, if you think of my hands as alveolar walls, and now you get the scarring, we know that these scar tissue contract and reabsorb, and you get all these coalescence of the alveolar walls, and now they make larger holes, and it reminds you that of a honeycomb, beehive. And so this is a irreversible damage because of this chronic injury. Do you think the patient feels this? Yes or no? No, they do not. And so it's the same thing with any condition that you're damaging the lung. You're not going to feel this process. What you'll feel is what? The inability to gas exchange. You'll be constantly hungry for oxygen. You'll need supplemental oxygen. What happens to the scarring, what happens here, these airways are dilated because the scar tissue around them contracts. We call this traction bronchiectasis, or dilation of the airways. And now this is all the lung that's left that the person uses to breathe. So now if you get a pneumonia in this patient who has interstitial lung disease, what do you think the likelihood of surviving is, high or low? It's low. So when people have a diagnosis of interstitial fibrosis, if they get an acute injury to the lung, whatever the cause, pneumonia or acute lung injury, they are in real trouble because they don't have any reserve left in order to give away. This is what it looks like. Here you can, let's go back here. Here you see alveolar wall, nice and thin. What do you notice about the thickness of these alveolar walls? Too thick. So gas exchange is going to be severely hampered. And now you're going to lead to hypoxia. Here you see macrophage, the alveolar sac. Here are the type 2 pneumocytes that are bulging out. And then you see all the scar tissue in the alveolar wall with fibroblasts. And this is all this chronic process. So that's why they use steroids to see if they get a response and minimize the scarring. If not, then it can proceed and continue on to produce more scarring. What can happen now, what do you think happens to the blood flow through the pulmonary circulation? The right heart has to pump blood into a lung that's becoming severely fibrotic. Is it going to make the afterload decreased, unchanged, or increased? If you're on the right side of the heart and you hit a pump into a lung that was fibrotic, would it be easier or difficult? Difficult. So now what they develop is pulmonary hypertension. Normally your blood pressure in the pulmonary arteries is going to range between 20 to 30 systolic pressure compared to 90 to 110 systolic on the systemic arterial side. So what can happen is if you have this interstitial lung disease, you can now develop atherosclerotic plaques in your pulmonary arteries as a consequence of this hypertension. Now, here we have a cross-section of the heart. Which side is bigger, the left or the right? Remember, we're looking at the heart. When we look at pathologists, the left is the left and the right is the right. So which part of the heart is too big? The right side. Because what's going to happen is that right, look at the right ventricular chamber on the right side here, it's huge compared to that of the left. Because if that heart has to work harder on the right side, which is only 3 millimeters, it becomes hypertrophied first. But what's going to happen is that contractility will eventually be lost because of the increasing pressure, and then it dilates. That's why the chamber. So this is what we call cor pulmonale. When you have intrinsic lung injury that prevents blood from passing through it, then the blood backs up. You have high pressure on the right side, leading to hypertrophy, and then dilation, and then failure. Then they're going to basically get anasarca as a consequence to this. So we talked about, do you have any questions about diffuse interstitial lung diseases? Will you see this in practice? Yes. Then we talk about emboli. What's the most common source of emboli, pulmonary emboli? Deep vein thrombosis. Very good. And that's what you think of. It can also occur in air. We talked about this in fluid hemodynamic derangements. And if you have right-sided vegetations on the right side of the heart, it can become emboli and go to the lungs. Venous thrombosis and pulmonary emboli. Immobilization of the extremity. We talked about this. Congestive heart failure, because the venous side, especially on the right side, will have stasis of blood, increase the likelihood of clotting and leading to a thrombosis. Any type of trauma, fractures, burns, causing tissue injury, releasing tissue factor and promoting, and then stasis of blood promoting thrombosis. And postpartum or delivery, you have all that blood, you increase the volume of the blood during pregnancy, and depending upon how much blood it can lead, and the estrogen increases the clotting factors, leading to hypercoagulability state, and so it can occur at this time. So clinical manifestations, depending upon the size of the emboli, we went through this, it can decide how much of the arteries or the blood flow that's going to be disrupted. And so what do you think is the most common symptom somebody would have with a pulmonary emboli? We talked about this earlier. What would they complain about first? If you had somebody with PE, what would they complain about clinically right away? Shortness of breath, that's the first thing. What's the heart going to do reflexively, physiologically? Increase heart rates. They're going to get tachycardia. Then they could, why would they develop chest pain? You could lead to hypoxia, but how? Occlusion of the pulmonary artery. Now you got to tell me the rest of the story. How do I get that to chest pain? If I have occlusion of the pulmonary arteries, what happens to the volume of blood that gets to the left side of the heart? Decreases. What happens to stroke volume? Decreases. Then what happens to the diastolic filling of your coronary arteries? Decrease. And then what happens to the heart? Then it's going to be strained and you get now chest pain as a consequence. Sudden death would be a massive pulmonary embolus where you wouldn't allow blood to get to the left side of the heart. And what's going to happen to your blood pressure? It really would go down and death would occur. What would be the first thing? They would collapse because what organ would not get enough perfusion to it? I'm using it right now to figure, I heard it. The brain, the B word. You lose consciousness and you would die. It'd be fairly quick. As a consequence, so you get sudden chest pain, you can have a fainting spell, shortness of breath, And if you infarcted the lungs because of a PE, you may even cough up blood because of the area, that depends on how big the area that's infarcted because of the pulmonary embolus. So when you have small emboli going in the lungs, you don't feel it, except if they accumulate over a period of time, then you'll start getting shortness of breath, for example. Here we see a large pulmonary embolus occluding the pulmonary artery, and you see this large hemorrhagic infarct, and I showed you this before. So the last thing before going to the next topic is pulmonary hypertension. We talked about hypertension on the systemic arterial side. You can also get on the pulmonic side hypertension. And typically, 1% of all pulmonary hypertension is idiopathic, and it usually occurs in young women of unknown etiology. No one knows. So it may have a genetic predisposition for developing this. And obviously, if you have the vessel walls becoming thickened, the lumen becomes decreased, decreasing blood flow, so they can have fatigability because they can't deliver enough oxygen. Gas exchange is going to be impaired. They may have loss of blood flow to the brain, get a syncopal episode, dyspnea on exertion, and occasionally, if it's severe enough, not getting enough blood and oxygenation, especially demand on the myocardium, they can get chest pain or angina pectoris. The vast majority of pulmonary hypertension is going to be to 99% is due to other diseases that we just talked about. For example, if you have chronic pulmonary emboli, you're shouting the lungs all the time, you don't feel it, but you cause organization and leading to pulmonary hypertension. If you have interstitial fibrosis or chronic infiltrative lung diseases, that can impede blood flow and lead to pulmonary hypertension. If you have congenital heart disease, where you're having a lot of blood from the left side to the right side of the heart, like a VSD or ventricular septal defect, the more blood flow going from the left ventricular chamber to the right ventricular chamber, then to the pulmonary artery in the lungs, what can happen is, over a period of years, is changes to the vessel walls that make them thicken and less compliant and impede blood flow. So you don't have to memorize this, but we talked about when you develop pulmonary hypertension, you get atheromas or atherosclerosis. You get thickening of the intima with fibrosis, and the media becomes thickened. Basically, it makes it less compliant and the lumen smaller, preventing blood flow. And then there are severe lesions that can occur in the small arteries that further impede blood flow, leading to a strain on the right side of the heart, leading to choropulmonale and right-sided failure. This is what a pulmonary artery looks like in this disease. When you look at both primary and secondary, you can see these slit-like spaces. It is replaced the normal lumen, and here you can see the lumen is severely curtailed because of the thickness of the wall. Any questions about those conditions? All right. Let's talk about, we talked about restrictive lung disease, and they'll talk about it, or if they haven't, in respiratory physiology, is obstructive. And there are four conditions. Oh, one other thing that you should think of that can also lead to restrictive is when you have these acute and chronic lung conditions. Another common cause of restrictive lung disease involves the volume of the lung is involving the chest wall. What do you think is the most common form of restrictive lung disease in the United States that involves the chest wall that you're going to see in your clinical practice? 33% of the adult population has this condition. Think about it for a minute. That's a lot of people, isn't it? It is obesity, is correct. Next time you're standing next to a patient who is obese, listen to them breathe. If you think you had 10 to 15 centimeters of fat around your chest cavity, would it be easy to expand your chest wall? No. And so if you want to see what it feels like to be morbidly obese, go home tonight, lay down in your bed, and put books on your chest and try to breathe. Or have somebody sit on your chest. It's the same feeling because you're not able to expand the chest wall. So if people have kyphosis or abnormal curvature or scoliosis, of the spine can alter the volume and decrease and lead to a restrictive pattern. So this is important to realize that the pathophysiology not only involves the lung itself, but also the chest wall. If it is produces less volume, it'll have a restrictive pattern as well. Okay. So now let's go to obstructive. This is a problem of what? Expiration. That's how you think of these. They give it different names, different conditions, but it comes down to this problem of inability to expire air. Other terms you'll see that patients come in with is COPD, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. Now, this is a hybrid term. In other words, it can have combinations of these various four types of pure obstructive airway diseases. One is emphysema, which we'll talk about, where you have dilation of your air spaces. You can have obstruction due to chronic mucus production. We call this chronic bronchitis that interferes with ability on expiration. If you have asthma, how many people have had asthma as a child? Yeah. This is a reactive airway disease. So you obstruct, you basically cause, you fill with mucus and the wall gets thicker, plus the bronchoconstriction is going to impair the ability to get air out. Then the last one is dilation of your airways, and this is called bronchiectasis. Ectasis means dilation. What two genetic diseases produce this? Is cystic fibrosis, a problem of the chloride channel, as well as a problem of cilia called cartaginers. So let's go through each one of these and look at the various examples. But they all give what type of lung disease? Obstructive. So it's a problem of inspiration or expiration? Expiration. So when you look at this, emphysema is a condition where you're going to damage the acinar units or the alveolar walls or sacs, and they become dilated. So the most common one you'll see in patients is central acinar or central lobular. Then when it involves all the alveolar sacs, we call it pan-acinar or pan-lobular, comes by various names. Periseptal, along the intraalveolar septa, can cause damage to those alveolar sacs. There's another one called irregular. You'll hear this term in the patient's clinical chart, and it means there's scarring. Typically, emphysema does not produce a lot of scarring in the alveolar sacs, but in irregular, you do get fibrosis, making it thicker, and the lung becomes less compliant. So here are the two patterns that you need to remember is central acinar and pan-acinar. What is the condition that most likely produces this is air pollution. Smoking, marijuana, cigarettes, pipe smoke, cigars, doesn't matter. Because you think of those chemicals coming down the airways in those branches that take place, where's the damage going to take place at is in the central lobular area where those alveolar sacs around the respiratory bronchioles, and it causes the air spaces to dilate while preserving the distal component of the alveolar sacs. While pan-acinar involves all the alveolar sacs distally, and this is usually to an enzyme deficiency called alpha-1-antitrypsin. It's made by hepatocytes in the liver. It's a deficiency because we release proteases all the time, and we need to often neutralize them. Otherwise, they're going to have a digestive effect like elastase and collagenase. Yes.
Is there a worse prognosis for
pan-acinar? They're both bad because we know that. Can the lung regenerate once you digest the walls? So either type has
a,
no, because you're eventually you're gonna get whatever alveolar sacs you first destroy centrally will eventually destroy them peripherally as well. As you continue to smoke or air pollution, it gets worse. Okay. This is the whole idea. Remember we talked about tethering? Here you see a bronchiole, and what do you see next to it? You see those alveolar walls attached to it. Now you release lytic enzymes like collagenase and elastase, and now you basically digest the wall away, and now what happens to that airway? What do you notice about the number of alveolar walls attached to it is decreased. So now in expiration, since you don't have the structural support to keep them open, they're now going to collapse and now lead to an obstructive airway pattern. Okay. So this is what a normal lung looks like. You can see this is dried out. You have no pigment in your lung. When it's fresh, it's pink. And then you can see the alveolar sacs. Here you see the normal delicate airways, I mean the airways and alveolar sacs. Now when we do central asthma due to cigarette smoking, it's going to be more common in the upper lobes and then eventually the lower lobes because the ventilation and gases and fumes rise. And you can see the central asthma, and this is what it looks like. What do you notice? You see those big dilated air spaces. And each one of those represents a lobular unit in the lung. And the patient, does the patient feel this when they digest their lung when they're smoking? Anything? No. And that's why they'll say, I'm smoking, I've been smoking for 40 years, 2 packs a day. I feel great. It's been damaged. Until they ask them to go hiking with you and see what happens. Because the surface area has decreased and we got problems. Yes?
What did you say, alpha-1 antitrypsin?
Trypsin, it's an anti-protease. So it's going to be, it'll neutralize protease activity like collagenase and elastase. Since the lung is made of elastin or collagen, it won't be able to, it'll digest the lungs when you basically don't have this anti-protease, because you normally release proteases all the time. So you have to neutralize them so the enzymatic activity doesn't go run amok. That make sense? If you have enzymes, you have to control those enzymes, otherwise it's going to chew up things.
So these are enzymes, right?
That prevent protease activity, like elastase and collagenase. That's what alpha antitrypsin is. Anti. So trypsin is a common enzyme that we produce, so you want to be able to neutralize it, otherwise you're going to proteolytically digest your own flesh, which is not good, right? And this is what it looks like. The last thing is, before we stop at this point, this is, you notice the air spaces are dilated. If you look carefully, you can see the dilation of the air spaces. And you can see that gas exchange is the problem, okay? Have a great day. This podcast was recorded by Dr. Henry Sanchez at the Samuel Merritt University California Podiatric School of Medicine and the University of California, San Francisco.